I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. The Florida legislative session is coming to a close, but lawmakers still have plenty of unfinished business. 90.7's political commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Fry wrap up the 2013 legislative session. Also, the Intersection team takes a look at the tech-based treasure-hunting sport of geocaching. We'll talk to casual geocacher Jenny Morrison, and we've also hidden a cache of our own somewhere in Central Florida. Inside are all sorts of WMFE goodies, including tickets to see Garrison Keillor. We'll tell you where it is and how to find it. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined by 90.7 political commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Fry. Dick Batchelor is a former Democratic State House representative. Welcome back, Dick.
Thank you. Good to be back.
And Lou Fry, a former Republican congressman. Nice to see you, Lou.
Go Gators.
Go Gators. Anyway, let's launch into the more weighty issues of the day. I guess Medicaid expansion was, the big issue this legislative session, but things haven't really resolved there, despite Governor Rick Scott changing his positions. Lou Fry, is this an issue that can be resolved, you think, or can it be brought up next session?
I think it's going to be brought up in a special session. And you're really looking at the amount of people that can be covered by this, how far down you could reach into the economic scale to do it, and also what's going to be in it, what program is going to be. One thing you have going for you, you have a really good president of the Senate and a really good Speaker of the House who actually talk to each other, who talk to Democrats, and they've set up an atmosphere where I think they can work out stuff a little bit quicker than you could when people were really shooting at each other, Dick.
I agree, but the problem is, though, and even the governor's now supporting the Medicaid expansion, you've got the Speaker of the House, Weatherford, who doesn't want to take any of the Medicaid dollars, even though there's about $57 billion available over the next 10 years. Senator Gates, the president of the Senate, has seemed to be more receptive to it. Then you've got Senator Negron, who's got a bill, which seems to be somewhat of a compromise, and that is, if the feds will let them do it, take the Medicaid monies that would be drawn down and use those to subsidize private insurance coverage, which is a good, I think a good compromise. But right now, I agree with Lou. I don't know how they can get it done in a regular session. I don't know, one, how they cannot do a Medicaid expansion and with a straight face. That's a tough issue. You can't. The $57.5 billion is taxpayers' money out of Florida anyway, and you only need about a $1.5 billion match over 10 years. I think they've got to do it. The House position is not to do it, but it is going to be interesting, and I think it's going to have to be resolved in a special session.
Lou Fry, what do you think of Negron's alternative?
There's a lot of them floating around. I don't think you can get locked in anyone because it changes so much. I think there's a need. And I think the need should be covered, and I don't think you're going to cover that need without having a special session of the legislature. You know, the other thing that I sort of, when you look at this, is that it's sort of fun in one way to see the governor and the legislature back in their normal positions at this point, mm-hmm. not liking each other and threatening each other with vetoing bills and so forth and so on. And you wonder if what is happening in this health area is going to be something that's going to impact the governor, because that was his thing, stop it all and everything. He flipped his position, so he's been both sides of it in that. And where does it sort of leave him?
Mm-hmm. They're not giving the governor everything he wants, and following up on Lou's thesis, they're not giving the governor everything he wants. The economic incentive package is woefully less than he asked for, one. They did give him the teacher pay raises, which is something he can take credit for, because they did cut the budget 2 years ago, and now he can be out front as a pro-education governor. So they seem to be giving him most of what he wants, not all of what he wants, to put him in a position that he cannot veto things. And keep in mind, too, if you go to a special session, you would be available to override vetoes. And everything that's passed has an overwhelming majority in the House and Senate. So if there is a special session, it's a big threat to the governor if he might want it on Medicaid. But everything he vetoes, they can reinstate.
I don't think the Republicans running the thing want to make him look bad. I don't think they're going out of the way to make him a hero, but I don't think they want to make him look bad, so there's a chance that that'll help him when it comes to some of these other bills that he signed. And there's some good bills that have passed up there. The education online bill to get a baccalaureate, I think that's wonderful. I don't know if he gets full credit for it or not, but that idea certainly never went anywhere before. And, I think that's a real good idea, Dick.
I think what is interesting is watching the Senate leadership in particular, because Senator Gates, who basically is already kind of, he understands there are going to be vetoes. As you well know, Florida Tax Watch every year comes out after the session and has a list of what they call turkeys. Turkeys are things that were funded that did not go through the appropriations process. They were stuck in at the conference committee or someplace else. They weren't heard in the House or the Senate. So they call them turkeys. And they sometimes add up to several hundred millions of dollars. This year, because they had money, there are a lot of turkeys. Now the question is, does the governor then veto these turkeys, including appropriations for senior members of the committee, including the Senate President, Speaker of the House, or does he kind of gulp and go with it? And or does he use that as a threat against some of the other legislation? So if the governor is a good leader, and if he's a good governor, if he's a good negotiator, he's sitting down with the leadership now saying, you can have this, but I got to have this. I mean, if it's people who don't believe it's a give and take are missing.
I talked to one of the key people in the governor's office, something totally different, but we'd known him for a number of years and talked about it. And they got a shop that's pretty active up there. They are in the ballgame. They aren't sitting on the sidelines saying you can run a state like a business. And I think they're going to do a good job of representing the governor, and there'll be some give and take, but I don't think it's going to be a one-way street.
Well, let's move on to a legislation with some local impact. The proposed soccer stadium here in Orlando for Major League Soccer. Now, there's a vote on a bill that would include soccer stadiums as part of the annual subsidies, and that's been postponed. But how important is that piece of legislation for Mayor Dyer and, I guess, for Orlando City Soccer to get their new stadium?
Oh, I think anything that adds to the jobs and adds to us as a community that brings in sports, and that is important. I know I've worked for some time. Tom Winter is a doctor, and that has been trying to get baseball into here. He'll get it, I think. He's tried for 20 years. But you look at the events that go on. You go around the state. My kids were swimmers, and so you'd go to some place, and there'd be 5,000 people, parents there and everything, you know, with their kids and people buying meals and doing all that kind of thing. So I think if you can look at the numbers and they're anywhere within reason, I would think it makes sense to have a soccer stadium and a better baseball stadium and hopefully someday, not now, but someday maybe a better big stadium downtown.
Dick Batchelor, let me just ask you a question about Mayor Jacobs. Now, she, along with the county commissioners, control the tourism tax. That would give the project, the soccer stadium project, $25 million. She hasn't made a decision yet on whether those funds would be spent on that stadium. Do you see the mayor and the county getting behind it?
I think there are two issues. One is a local issue, and that is when Jacob Stewart, the leader of the chamber, led the effort along with others to say, build the mall, build them now, Performing Arts Center, expansion of the Citrus Bowl, and in the Orlando Magic, the arena. The reason they did that is because, frankly, they were trying to get the support of the hotel lodging industry, because they're the ones that collect and remit the tax. And the question was, does it put heads in the bed? Performing Arts Center does not. Some people come from out of town, not many. Orlando Magic, and that was the big argument. The people who go to Orlando Magic are primarily people who live here. Mm-hmm. So we're not expanding the economy per se, but they put in the Citrus Bowl expansion because that is worth probably a couple hundred million dollars in economic impact with the Capital Bowl game and the Classic. So they kind of combine them together so they could get support from the tourism industry. That's one. Number two, at the state level, traditionally you would allow a sales tax rebate back to against which to issue debt to build these stadiums. But now it's interesting. Senator Gardner basically says, well, I would just want to collapse them all. You have to apply, and we'll figure out which one really merits the funding. So that's really completely turnaround. So you've got one, the old way of doing it is allowing the Miami Dolphins, again, to have the sales tax rebate for 20 or 30 years against which to issue debt to expand, and the other teams too, including soccer. But then you've got this proposal to say, well, maybe you have to earn it. So I think that's going to be one that might.
I don't want to get in the middle of that war right now.
Yeah, but I think the soccer stadium. I think soccer could lose in that proposition.
Lou Fryer, let's just talk a little more about ethics reform. Now, campaign contribution caps have increased under this legislature. What does that mean for elections?
Well, what we're trying to do basically is make sure that everybody knows what's going on and everything's transparent to begin with. And we're also trying to do something about limiting the amount of money and limiting special committees, which seem to get around the money, and that's what they've been aimed at. Money is wrecking our political system. It truly is fire in a movie theater, and we've tried to limit it. The U.S. Supreme Court said we couldn't do it in U.S. versus Vallejo. We couldn't limit the time of that. That was years ago. Ever since then, we've been trying to figure out ways to do it. doing a better job on it. The big super PACs had some impact on the election, not as much as I thought they would have, but the election wasn't that close either. So, you know, I think I'm all for it. I go after it, and if you can get it all, fine. If you can get part of it, fine. But I think we've got to continue to build on that base. It would be nice if Florida was known for, A, not having people stand in line for a while to vote, but we had all that taken care of. And also if we had legislators in that who really did want some reform and did make it everything on the table. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever you have, mm-hmm. let's put it on the table and people can judge it yes or no, but no hiding behind committees.
Dick Batchelor, do you think Florida could become known as a state where everything is on the table and we don't have this reputation as being somewhat shadowy in terms of ethics?
I think we're headed in the direction. First of all, I do say that I think Citizens United case, which is a Supreme Court case where they ruled that a corporation has the same constitutional standing, which means they could get unlimited contributions, is the worst case in the last 50 years in the U.S. Supreme Court won. Secondly, I applaud the legislature and Republican leadership for taking up election reform and ethics reform. They're trying to do away with these committees' continuing existence, which basically legislators would create. Then they will allow unlimited contributions to those funds, which they would use to advance their causes, as opposed to the hypocrisy of limiting campaign contributions to $500 a primary in the general. But the purists say they don't like the bill now because it increases from a $500 contribution to $1,000 and statewide candidates from $500 to $3,000, suggesting that invites even more money pay to play in politics. So there's a compromise there. I'm glad they're doing away with the CCEs. I think we need transparency there. Those were not transparent at all. But the question is now whether or not there's some compromise to increase the amount of money you can give to a campaign, but not $1,000 and $3,000.
When you look at the money put in, $500 or $5,000, in a statewide race, that's a pittance. That doesn't even get you a seat outside to look in at the kind of thing. And if you look at inflation and a lot of things, there's not that much difference between the money now and the money it is today. I wouldn't have heartburn at all if it was $5,000 and that was it, because the problem is now it's a lot less, and then you get the add-ons and you end up with a lot more money going into it than you would otherwise.
The sad point is we might be at a point of no return, and I hate to say that, but you know, when legislators used to spend $100,000 voting, which was at that point in time an obscene amount of money. People now are spending over $1 million for a single-member House seat.
That's in the legislature. That's
the legislature.
Not the Congress. Yeah, make people
Congress.
Understand
That's just
that.
The legislature. And people spending well over $1 million for Florida Senate race. It's obscene. Well, my theory is this. It's a very basic one. My theory is with the exponential increase in dollars spent in campaigns, the average voter has a diminution of their influence. The more money spent outside of with the large groups, the less influence that you have. And that's where we're headed. So anything that will help, notwithstanding the Supreme Court decision, if we can at least force transparency, it will help.
And why don't we take some of that money, if we're going to use it, and they're doing it to destroy the system, why don't we take 20% of that money to educate the people in the United in our state so they know that there are three branches of government? I mean, if you're going to get that money.
Lou Frey just suggested a tax on campaign contributions. Yeah. Won't offend anybody but the candidates.
Willful,
I'm in favor of
a willful contribution.
A willful contribution. A civic pride.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm Matthew Petty. I'm speaking with 90.7 political commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Frey. You can join the conversation online on Facebook and Twitter. You can also email us at intersection@wmfe.org. Lou Frey, let me ask you a question about the influence of big money in politics. And I don't know if you've been following particularly closely the mandatory sick time legislation that's been sort of wending its way through the legislature, but do you have any thoughts on where this is heading and what the implications are?
No, Dick's the expert on that.
Well, I'll tell you, it headed for its demise. I mean, obviously there was a proposed referendum on sick leave in Orange County, and the county commission deferred it and got in trouble with some texting situation. But now there's legislation basically that says you can't do it. You know, it's a state preemption. It's interesting. The state really believes, they're conservative, they really believe in local government decisions until the local government makes a decision they don't agree with. And then they try to preempt it. But right now, even though it's scheduled to be on the ballot in 2014, with this piece of legislation pass that basically preempts it until they have a study. I think
that would take a few years.
All intents and purposes, that's dead.
Just a couple more questions. Dick Batchelor, Senator Nelson has been quite busy in the last sort of month or so. Does that sort of portend anything, do you think? Do you think he might be thinking about a run for governor at some point?
I would love for Bill Nelson to run for governor, even though, and Lou will speak to this, I'm sure, you just got reelected as United States Senator. You're the senior senator from Florida. You've got, you know, five more years to go in your term. You know, do you really want to do that? But as a Democrat, we don't have a strong bench when it comes to gubernatorial candidates. So just selfishly speaking, Bill Nelson would be an extraordinarily strong candidate. He'd been a member of the State House, Congress, Insurance Commissioner, United States Senator. So he's a very strong candidate with name recognition.
Yeah, I think from the political standpoint, it'd be wonderful if he ran for it. I think I would have Bill committed to give up a safe Senate seat that he's there, that he has seniority in that. But, you know, that people have different things. Mel Martinez got up there, and he frankly didn't like being in the Senate. I'd sure be great to do that. And Lawton Childs, he didn't like Washington at all. I mean, he just didn't like Washington.
Came back to be governor.
And the other thing from the political parties and from the people who are in the trenches, they'd much rather have a governor than a senator. Senator, maybe you can get a judge appointed or do something like this. But if you're the governor of this state, I don't know how many hundreds of jobs you have a lot more direct impact on it. And it may be Bill's feeling at the end of this thing, this is a heck of a way to, you know, to go out to do it this way. And he'd be very difficult to beat. And that would take the Charlie Crist issue right off the table.
Well, keep in mind, too, and I think you alluded to it in a previous program, that if he were elected, he does not have to resign to run. If he were elected governor, he could actually appoint the United States Senator to replace him. So, I mean, it makes it a very interesting scenario there. At least it's something to talk about.
Let me just ask a final wrap-up question. Has this legislative session sort of played out the way you thought it would?
I thought this was going to be a more civil legislation. I thought that the governor, we saw it coming, was going to get involved in a more practical and positive way than before. They had money to play with, so it didn't have near the recriminations that you'd have in most. And it was a relatively quiet session so far, and who knows what's going to happen if we have that special session.
Pleasant surprises, and I think, and I've already alluded to them, is the Senate leadership and the House leadership taking up things like election reform, ethics reform, funding education. Somebody said, well, they have a new mindset. And I said, well, it's called an epiphany. It was called an election. After the last election, when Barack Obama did so well and the Republicans didn't do that well, and the legislature, they did perfectly fine. There were only four Democrats, new Democrats, elected. But I still think they took a deep breath and said, look, what we're advancing is not working there. So I think you're going to see a lot more overtures. And I still think, I'm not giving up on Medicaid, I still think they're going to see when they have a time to take a deep breath, which they don't now within a session, can look at it and see it's probably the right thing to do. But I think you see that at the local level, at the state level. And I think in Congress you're seeing the same kind of action on immigration, which we can talk about another time, which is a signal that, look, we need to think differently about some of these things.
And May coming up, what I hear in Washington, people are going to make that one of these do-or-die dates, not to kick it down the road, so we don't have much time to enjoy what civility we have.
I've been speaking to 90.7 political commentators Lou Fry and Dick Batchelor. Lou Fry, thanks for coming in.
Always a pleasure.
And Dick Batchelor, nice to see you again.
Likewise, thank you.
Up next, a look at the world of geocaching. Listen for the location of WMFE's hidden cache and your chance to find Garrison Keillor tickets. Geocaching is a game of treasure hunting with about 4 million participants worldwide. It's said to be one of the fastest growing recreational social media activities. Geocachers find coordinates online, then they use a GPS device like a cell phone to locate the cache, usually a watertight container like a pill jar, Tupperware or an ammunition box. We sent Intersections assistant producer Brendan Byrne to the Seminole Cross County Trail with the University of Central Florida Geocaching Club to try it out firsthand.
Caches can be found just about anywhere, in parking lots, hiking trails, and even businesses. Once a cache is hidden, the coordinates are uploaded to a website where they can be loaded onto a mobile device. Patrick Walsh had downloaded a set of caches we would be looking for today.
Basically, we're finding geocaches that have already been posted online, putting in the coordinates, following or using the GPS to follow the coordinates to what we call ground zero. Once we get to ground zero, we'll all kind of spread out and then just start looking for something out of the ordinary, and usually that will be the geocache.
Our first cache was in a supermarket parking lot. Patrick had his GPS device out as we got closer.
Right now we're down to 60 feet. Basically there's a checker flag and a line, and we're just trying to get closer, and I'm down to 46, 43. And it's not perfect. Usually when you get close, it starts to kind of get iffy, so...
Despite the high-tech nature of the sport, GPS can only take you so far. The group spread out and used low-tech methods of kicking around brush to look for anything out of the ordinary. The cache was a small pill bottle, painted black to blend into the surroundings. On the cap was a plastic lemongrass frond as camouflage. Inside, a tiny scroll of paper. Each of the cashers signed their name on the log and put it back the way they found it. Crystal Moore explained some of the rules of geocaching.
If the cache is big enough to have things in it, and you say you want to take something out, you have to leave something of equal value in. You have to hide it exactly the same way that you found it.
We also had to make sure we didn't draw too much attention to ourselves.
You gotta watch out for people, too.
You gotta
make sure people don't see you, because sometimes they mess with the caches and stuff, so you gotta keep it on the DL.
Our next cache led us to a wooded area off the Cross County Trail.
This is called bushwhacking because there's no definite trail, and usually not favored by a lot of new geocaches just because, I mean, no one likes to hike through, like, brush.
Mm-hmm.
But you get used to it after a while for stuff like this.
That was Nick here. As the group was searching through the brush, Nick told me about another rule of geocaching.
So, yeah, it's an initiative called CETO, Cache In, Trash Out. So basically, like, while you're out there, because there will be trash occasionally just with any wilderness part of it, and when you go in, try to take a piece of trash with you, at least one, just to kind of clean up the area around it. So it's kind of a nice green initiative to promote it, I guess, when you're going out. Just because when you're out there anyway, bring a trash bag with you, maybe pick up a few pieces of trash and go along your way.
Further down the trail, we found a larger cache with a few surprises inside.
It's a big one, actually. So they got the log in there, some erasers, a pin, and this is like someone's, I guess, tag, or it's a, what do we call it, travel bug?
Yeah, so this is a trackable. So basically, they have a unique code on it. If you find it, you'll go online, put in this code, you can see everywhere it's been. Basically, it travels from cache to cache, and they'll have missions. This one doesn't have really a specific mission, but some will be like, I want to go to Niagara Falls, and people will help it move from cache to cache all the way up there. It's really cool.
Some go international.
The cachers tell me some of the prizes get sent all over the world. The geocachers logged each find from their smartphone. This keeps a record, and as Chris Rogers explains, it also gives feedback to the person who hid the cache.
You're supposed to type a little message explaining your experience finding it. So I mean, as a cache owner, you wanna read those experiences that people had a good time finding your cache.
With a slew of fresh caches logged, we headed back.
It's just a fun hobby. Like, we're outside. I love walking. I love the concept and everything about it.
That's one of the pros I think everybody kind of talks about geocaching, is it takes you to places you never would have found pretty much without geocaching.
Yeah.
That was Crystal Moore and Patrick Walsh ending that report from 90.7 associate producer Brendan Byrne. To talk more about geocaching, I'm joined now in the studio by Jenny Morrison. Jenny is a geocacher here in the Central Florida area. Jenny, thanks very much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So just explain a little bit, what kind of things do you find when you're out there?
All kinds of things. On my very first geocache, I found two tickets to a comedy lab in downtown Orlando for a free show and two free drink tickets. And the idea is that you take a treasure, leave a treasure, so that there's always something left for the next geocacher.
So when you meet other geocachers, do you sort of instantly have a connection with them?
Absolutely. You can always talk about your latest cache and how hard it was to find or how easy it was to find, or recommend them to a really good one that you found.
Are there certain things you don't do if you're a geocacher?
There's absolutely a lot of rules. One, of course, being that you try to be as discreet as possible when looking for a geocache. You don't want the keyword, the muggles, to discover where the geocache is, because they will muggle it or tarnish it, ruin it, alert the police to it, things of that nature.
Now, muggle, that's a word from Harry Potter, right?
I believe so.
How did that come about?
I don't know. It was just a word I discovered along the way, and there is a whole geocaching vocabulary, and it's just something you pick up as you go.
So what do you need to start?
All you need is a GPS device or a smartphone, which most of them are GPS-enabled now, and just the coordinates to your very first geocache, and you can get going.
And is it something that people tend to do in a group?
I think it's always safer to do it in a group just because you could be going through a forest or you could be in a weird area all by mistake. So I always recommend being in a group. But I will say I've gone out a couple times to places like the beach with my dog, and we found them ourselves. Depending on how hard the geocache is to get to, a lot of people take their pets or their children. They range from being as easy to being hid under some leaves by a tree to places that you need to have a shovel or a fishing line to get to places that you need an actual boat to get to.
Is there a core of people who are really into it in Central Florida?
There is a core, and they even have, you know, internet meetup groups for them and things like that. But it's also excellent because we have a lot of tourists to pass through, so a lot of trackables get passed through this area.
What is a trackable?
A trackable is either a coin or a small animal or something with a tracking number on it. So much like wheresgeorge.com, where you can track where your dollar bill is going, you can track how these trackables get passed from geocache to geocache. And you can pick one up at one geocache, place it at another one farther away or up the street, and you can track where it goes online. I've seen trackables land in Orlando that have been from Miami, and I found them here, and it'll say, my goal is to get from Miami to Seattle. So I was going on a road trip, so I brought it with me, and I brought it with me to Nashville. And you're a little bit closer, trackable, so I'll leave you here.
People do have pretty ready access to GPS devices, you know, with their smartphones, but do you get the sense there might be some modification coming up with new technology? Could you see this pastime changing at all with new technology coming online?
It's definitely evolved a lot over the last year. There are now applications available that will simply just pop the coordinates themselves right into your GPS. That way you don't have to go find the coordinates. It'll say, hey, there's one right around the corner from you. Stop what you're doing and come find this. And there's some that will automatically alert to you that your trackable's been picked up or located, things of that nature. It's come really far. And now a new trend is that geocaches are hidden with riddles. So in order to actually discover it, the GPS location will get you close, but you have to solve the riddle to actually find it. And that's where kind of the difficulty level is a great thing to come into play. You know, if you're going out with the kids, it's always easy to just have an easy one where the kids can grab the GPS and run and find it. But if you're going out with a group of friends, it might be more challenging to find the one where one of you actually has to hike up the tree.
So we've hidden a cache somewhere in Central Florida for our intersection listeners to find. And I'm going to give out the coordinates at the end of the program. But I'm wondering, Jenny, if you could walk us through the steps the listeners would have to take to find that geocache.
You can open up your GPS device and put in the GPS coordinates straight into your GPS device. Go ahead and follow the directions. And generally, there is a specific tip on where to find it once you get there. And maybe a clue like look up or look down and you're on your way. It's that easy.
I've been speaking in the studio with Jenny Morrison, an avid geocacher here in Central Florida. Jenny, thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks so much.
The WMFE cache is located at north 28 degrees 37.492, west 81 degrees 15.007. The hint is don't get wet. We'll post the coordinates online as well on our Facebook and Twitter. Good luck. The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.